Now, that's a separate conversation, and the press hasn't really figured this out yet. That's a separate conversation from who's going to lead our frontier in space. It's not going to be private enterprise. Not because I don't want it to be. It's just that it never has been. And there are really cogent reasons for this. All right, imagine the venture capitalist meeting with Elon Musk. He gathers his most entrepreneurial VCs and says, okay, what do you want, Elon? I need $1 trillion. Why? I want to go to Mars. Does it really cost that much? Yes. Is it dangerous? Yes. Will people die? Probably. What's the return on that investment? None for the foreseeable future. That's a 5-minute meeting.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold 2 businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Neil deGrasse Tyson is by far the smartest person I have ever met in my life. And it's not even close. And if you call him smart, like I did, you'll get a fascinating answer to how he thinks about what is really considered smart. It's typical Neil from what his legions of fans love so much about him. And he didn't disappoint when I sat down with him earlier this month to discuss being an astrophysicist, cosmologist, scientist, author, and of course, entrepreneur. I love learning about the first time he walked into the Hayden Planetarium as a child and having that feeling at that moment that he knew right then and there what would become his lifetime interest. In fact, he went on to become the director of the same world-famous planetarium as an adult. Of course, he has accomplished so much more in his life. His story is coming up after the break. Coming up with a name for your business can be difficult. Finding a matching domain can be even harder. Don't settle for a website name, you know, that's kind of close. Show strength and brand continuity with a domain name that is the exact match to your business name. .inc offers premium, instantly credible domains built for businesses of all sizes. Startups everywhere are switching to the domain ending that means business. From reset.inc to self.inc, a .inc domain will help put your brand alongside Fortune 500 companies like Facebook, PayPal, and Amazon. .inc is the domain that means business for your business. Establish your online presence by registering your .inc domain today. Visit entrepreneur.inc to learn more. And now, on with the show. I had first met Neil playing in a summer softball game. I was wearing a Super Bowl 50 hat, and the first thing he asked me after asking, of course, if I was related to the famous author Barbara Tuckman, was if I knew why the NFL had the number 50 on the hat instead of their normal Roman numerals. Huh? It was a Saturday softball game, and I had no idea who he was, except after he gave me the answer, I was like, this guy is really smart, and he thinks in a different way. So when we sat down, I asked him if he remembered that story as to why the NFL had the number 50 on their license materials and not the Roman numerals.
It's a subject about which I've thought a lot. And so here it is. If you look at the Super Bowl and how it's marketed, Super Bowl 10, Super Bowl 15, Super Bowl 20, almost all of those Roman numerals have X's in them, okay? In fact, every Super Bowl from Super Bowl 10 onward has an X in it, okay? So this is very manly, right? Super Bowl X, V, Roman, gladiators, it's because those are Roman numerals. And so it's got all of this. And then I projected forward. I remember doing this about 5 years ago. And I even tweeted this observation. I said, Super Bowl 50, we lose the X's. It's just the letter L. So if they kept with Roman numerals, it would just be Super Bowl. Super Bowl L. Did you pronounce that? Is it a thing? It's kind of a less familiar Roman numeral to everybody, especially in the Super Bowl, in the football universe. So I thought maybe they should just use Arabic numerals, which would just be the numeral 5 and the numeral 0. And then they can return to it later, I guess. So sure enough, I don't know if I influenced it or not, or they just clear heads prevailed. But when Super Bowl 50 came around, they had 5-0. They did not have the L. They abandoned the Roman numerals for that year.
And I am sure it is exactly why they did it, being in sports marketing and working in it. I am sure. And, you know, at that time, I realized, in terms of just someone giving me insight, and I know you've provided incredible insight for so many people and beloved by so many people just for your take on the world and how you see it. And you're probably one of the most well-known scientists in the world. And I had read that early on, you had made a trip to the Hayden Planetarium, which is every New York City kid, or, you know, you get to go to the Hayden Planetarium. It's like the best day of school. But can you tell me what that was like and what that meant to you in your life and what you were going to do for your career when you made that first trip to the Hayden Planetarium?
Yeah, that first trip was not with school. As a school trip, we did visit the American Museum of Natural History, of which the Hayden Planetarium is a part, but we didn't go to the planetarium for the school trip. But we did go as a family trip. And now that I have been a parent, I now understand why our family went on trips every weekend, because it wore us out, my sister, my brother, and me. And so we would go to sleep early, and then my parents would have like peace and quiet over the weekend. I'm certain that's a large part of the reason why we went on these family trips. But we went on trips to, in sequence, it felt like every weekend, but maybe it was only two weekends a month, that we would visit cultural institutions, places where adults were experts at things that weren't traditional subjects that you learned about. These were adults that knew about science, and we went to the aquarium, we went to the opera. As a young kid, in retrospect, it's clear that this was an era of exposure. I think my parents wanted us to see all the things you could be when you grow up. And we visited art museums. And went to a hockey game and a football game. So it would take a couple of years. Oh, so one of them was the Hayden Planetarium. And I was starstruck by it. Wow. It's like, and I think I was struck by it because I grew up in New York City. And New Yorkers don't have a relationship with the night sky. You look up, you see a building or a slice of the sky between two other buildings. And it's light pollution. Back then, there was a lot of air pollution. And you're just not thinking about the night sky at all. You walk into a dome, the lights turn out, this voice comes out, that planetarium voice. They teach you that in planetarium director school.
I'm sure you learned it well.
Welcome to the universe. And so I just wonder what it would be like if you go to a planetarium show and a pipsqueak voice,
welcome to the planetarium. That's just... it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work.
It's just not going to... It just wouldn't play. So anyhow, you go in there and it's transformative. Anyone's first visit to any planetarium was probably your first immersive virtual reality experience. That's my guess, because it's happening all around you and the dome dissolves away and you are floating in the universe. And I thought, gosh, I bet everyone would want to be an astrophysicist after this. Turned out, no, that was not the case. But it would take a couple of years. By the time I was 11, that's when I realized I could do this as an adult. And so that's when I had the answer to that age-old annoying question that adults always ask kids, which is...
what do you want to be when you grow up?
My answer was astrophysicist. And people really didn't have a comeback on that one.
They just
walk away with their hors d'oeuvre.
Like, okay, I can't answer that.
Oh, no, Aunt Matilda's an answer. No, not really. Aunt Matilda's a lawyer, all right, or a doctor.
And then so I had read that, you know, it's just incredible for an 11-year-old to come at you with that. I could see how an adult could walk away because they probably just don't even understand it themselves.
I exaggerate a little, but it's fun to exaggerate those encounters. But yeah, but they didn't have a reference frame to continue the conversation in any sort of meaningful way. So it was awkward usually.
Yeah, which is interesting. And did you realize at that time, I hate to say you were smarter than most around you, did you realize at that time that you were able or had this knowledge that maybe not every other kid shared or not even every other adult?
Don't confuse ambition with knowledge, nor ambition with being smart. We have various definitions of, I hardly ever use the word. And because I don't think it communicates what people want it to mean. So for example, in school, everyone knew who the smart kids were. You just knew, and you knew who the dumb kids were. This ranking was baked into the setup of the school. You knew who, I had a teacher who handed back exams in reverse grade order
that
you
got.
So the first one was the highest. If you got your score, your exam the last, the whole class knew you got the lowest grade in the class.
Yeah,
that's right?
Terrible.
And I grew up at a time, I don't know if they still do this, where the classes were separated by smart classes and dumb classes. So you knew who the smart classes were, you knew who the dumb classes were. So as a child, you're embedded in this sorting machine. And in that sorting machine, the word smart is applied to people who get high grades, period. And at the end of the school, if you have the highest grades, you're valedictorian, that person is celebrated. They give the commencement speech. They're the one who we entrust will give us wisdom for continuing in life. They're the ones that get the applause and nobody else does. Okay. So that's a common usage, invocation of the word smart. Another one is, do you know a lot of stuff? Okay. So if you win at Jeopardy, you know, if you sweep 5 days at Jeopardy, no one's going to not call you smart.
It's a good point. Okay?
No one's going to say that. All right. I have a slightly different definition of smart. And even so, I don't use the word smart in this context. But let me just offer you another perspective. And this is a contrived example, but it makes the point that I want to make. Let's say I were an architect, and I had an architecture firm, and I have room for one intern over the summer. And there are two candidates that have damn near identical resumes on paper. So we got to do the interview. So one of them comes in. And again, this is contrived, so don't judge the literality of what I'm telling you. So one of them comes in, I say, you see that church steeple out the window? I said, yeah. And I say, how tall is that church steeple? I said, oh, it's 135 feet. And I said, wow, how did you know that? Well, I've studied the major structures in all cities, and I've memorized them, and I love thinking about how tall these are and what they're made of, and I have it all committed. Okay. Next person comes in. How tall is that church steeple? You know, I don't know. I'll be right back. And then they leave. And then they come back 10 minutes later, and they say, I'm not know for sure, somewhere between maybe 130 and 140 feet. And I said, well, how do you arrive at that? Well, I know how tall I am. And so I measured my shadow on the ground. Then I measured the shadow of the church steeple. And then I put it in the equation to figure out, and I came up with this number. So I ask you, who are you going to hire?
I am going to hire, and I think this is incredibly important, especially for our listeners, a lot of them being entrepreneurs. And one thing that I've noticed with many of these successful entrepreneurs, the person that shows ambition, the person that actually goes outside or goes and is willing to work or to put themselves out there. And I don't know if this is the right answer because I'm a little worried, but no. That is the person that I would hire.
Yeah, yeah, as would I. This is the person who figured it out. And what happened is we somehow lost sight of the figuring of things out in favor of the knowing of the answer. And somehow we value the knowing of the answer more than we value the figuring of the thing out. And again, I don't want to use the word smart, but for me, if I'm going to hire someone, I'm not hiring the person who knows all the answers. I'm hiring the person who has the inventiveness to figure out what the answer might be. And it's not just, let me Google it. It's, is there some way I can approach this? That's where the creativity is found. And it is true that the person who memorized it possibly could also figure that out. I don't know. We need a next round of interviews. But just on the face of it, I'm hiring the person who left for 10 minutes and came back. And so now with regard to ambition, think about it. You're in class. You have to learn this body of work or knowledge, and then there's a test on it. Often it's a regurgitation of information. So you're not really figuring things out. You're memorizing it. All right. So fine. So now you get the test. And let's say you do really well. Now, suppose I learn more slowly than you. Suppose I have to, you know, my brain isn't wired the way yours is. Your brain is wired in a way that's aligned with that of the teacher's. So the way the teacher is teaching it, that fits exactly into how you're learning. But suppose I learn things a little differently, either visually or auditorially or abstractly or literally. Whatever is the key to my learning is not the same key as it is to everyone else's learning. But I still care about the material. But I get the test and I'm only halfway through the material and I get a B minus. You get the A plus. You're the smart one. You're giving the commencement address. And I'm the one that no one looks towards. Yet I keep learning. I say, this is cool stuff. I'm going to get out a book on this. I'm going to watch this documentary. I'm going to read more about this. I'm going to do these extra problems on my own. And I keep learning, and you're done because you got the A+. So my ambition at the end of the day transcends your A+. But no one would call me smart for having that ambition of wanting to learn, but I have to learn in the way that I know how to learn. And I have to learn on a timetable commensurate with my life, not with that classroom's syllabus and curriculum. So I say to you that at no time in any year I've been in school did any teacher say, keep an eye on Tyson, he'll go far. No one did, because their metrics were not what I was fulfilling. I knew I was interested in the universe. I had a library of books at home, probably larger than any other library of any elementary school kid and middle school kid. Why? Because my parents saw that I was interested in the universe after they had brought me to the planetarium. By the way, neither of them are scientists. They didn't push us to be what they were or were not, or tried to become but weren't. You know, often the kid is the extension of the successes or failures of the parents. My parents had no such influence, only the exposure to all that people do. So my parents, realizing that I have this interest, they would frequent bookstores. And back then, and occasionally today, there would be a table, usually near the front entrance, of remaindered books.
Yes.
So these are books that the publisher isn't selling as fast as they are, and it's taking up space in the warehouse. So they shake the tree.
It's like my books. I wrote two. And my kids laugh because, you know, it's for free on Kindle, unlike yours, I am sure. So, but yes.
All right. So the books, they fall out of the tree and they put them on the shelf and they're released for a song to the booksellers, and they put a stripe across the binding. And you get, back then, it was 50 cents, 25 cents. And my family didn't have much money. But my mother knew that maybe I'd be interested in this physics book or this astronomy book or this brain teaser book or this puzzle book. So these entered my library. I can even say I had a library beginning in sixth grade and becoming large and significant by the time I was 15. All right. So this is all going on. And the teachers have no clue. They don't know what's going on. They don't have any idea. I'm head of the astronomy club. I walk dogs and at 50 cents per walk per dog, two walks a day, that adds up. And I use that money to buy my first astrophotography camera and my first real telescope. My parents gifted me a much smaller telescope when I turned 12. Once they saw that I'm ready to be an astrophysicist, I got like a $50 telescope from Sears, which is good enough to select the rings of Saturn and the craters on the moon and sunspots with the proper filters. So I outgrew the $50 Sears telescope. And 2 years later, I walked dogs, earned money, bought a telescope, built a dark room in my home. For those people under 45, a dark room is a place where you take film shot in a camera, put it through a series of chemicals, and then you dry it, and then you enlarge it, and you make prints. So I did this and taught myself photography, taught myself developing. All this is going on, and I show up in class, and I'm the deadbeat student because my grades are not A's. So here's another fact here that your audience might be interested to learn. I was profiled in The New Yorker, the good kind of profile. Profiling has a whole other meaning today.
Yeah, especially in The New Yorker.
So I was profiled in The New Yorker. And the interviewer, who shadowed me for a couple of months and attended some of my talks and saw me interact, they wanted to know a little bit more about my background. So we're sitting down in sort of interview mode and say, well, tell me about your grades. And I said, well, they were just kind of average, right? I got B's. Technically, historically, B should be above average.
A little bit above. That's not my C minus.
Right. That's not C minus.
I went through school with.
Okay. So I had B average. But at home, I was doing all these things. And so that got translated in the article to, most people don't know, Neil deGrasse Tyson was a mediocre student.
Exactly.
So if you're only thinking about grades, I guess you could say that. But let's not look at precise definition of words. Let's look at what that sentence means to you when you read that sentence. If you hear Joey Smith or Betty Sue are mediocre students, what images come to your head?
Yeah.
It's they don't, can't pay attention in class, they're deadbeats.
They don't care.
To me, that's a mediocre student. Or a student who's struggling and they can't get by. That's a mediocre student. I was anything but a mediocre student. I can tell you that right now, from age 9 onwards. So you say, was I smart? That's why I don't even have that conversation. I spend my life learning. And another factor here, you didn't ask this, but it's related. what's going on in school where most people, if not everyone, on the last day of school, runs down the steps, tossing their books in the air and saying, school's out! There's
yeah.
joy that school is over, either for the season, the semester, or for life. In fact, there's an Alice Cooper song, school's out,
out for summer.
School's out for, yes. I think it's Alice Cooper, right?
The school's out for summer. Yeah, there's
it's school's out forever. Is there a button following line?
Yeah.
So what that means is when your only job was to learn, that's your job. And somehow that's a chore, enough of a chore that you're glad you don't have to do it again. Well, if that's your attitude, you have ossified your brain in that moment. And the rest of your life, you're going to have to fit what you do, what you accomplish into what you learned up until that moment. And for me, I always enjoyed school. I was very sociable. So I liked the social aspects of it, as well as the academic aspects of it. And so we're doing something wrong as educators if people are overjoyed that school is over. Something's wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't have the easy answer, but I just want to highlight that as a problem.
Yes. And especially nowadays, there are a lot of parents who want the answer to that, especially with Zoom. And I mean, it's just been extremely difficult in any type of learning environment. But this is what I love about you, because we started with that question and we're already 25 minutes in. And this
I'm sorry. You have other questions, I'm sure.
This is why you're so great. You can get a really interesting conversation on one question. But one thing that you brought up and I love is ambition. And I want to see if you equate it ambition and sense of urgency, because I did hear someone once asked you if what it would be like if you wanted to, maybe you can explain, to live forever. And from what I recall, there was something in there about sense of urgency. And I just thought it was so genius. And do you recall what I'm talking about or trying to say?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So we might be on the brink of discoveries regarding the aging of the molecules that comprise human physiology, that we might be able to delay them or permanently stop the aging of your body's cells. And if that's the case, you can live longer and still have this sort of virility of your youth, so that you can live meaningfully into old age rather than just hanging on into old age. So who wouldn't want to do that? But I thought more deeply about it. And I said, well, if I can live forever, then that removes the urgency of the now. I could say, oh, I could do this. I could work on this project. I'll just do it tomorrow. And if you live forever, there's an infinite number of tomorrows. So I don't know if living forever is the best idea with regard to the forces that some of us, if not all of us, need to motivate us to do the things we want to do to contribute to this world or to enjoy this world. And even if you're not a scientist who's going to cure cancer, but suppose you're a hiker and there's some places you haven't hiked yet. All right. Are you going to make a plan this summer? No, I'll do it in 100 years. What? What does that even mean? What? And by the way, in other words, the fact that I'm going to die brings focus to every day that I am alive. And that's, by the way, I don't think that's weird. Consider that if you have a loved one and you want to celebrate something and you bring them flowers, let's say, you could bring them plastic flowers and they'll live basically forever, but you don't. Why not? Would your loved one appreciate the plastic flowers? No. Well, why not? Well, because we implicitly know and embrace the fact that the flower is going to die and you have to pay attention to it while it's alive. And embrace all that it offers and watch the petals unfold and look at the pistil and the stamen and just embrace this little bit of magic in nature while you have access to it. And then it dies and it becomes a memory. That is part of this, my understanding of myself, where no, I don't want to live forever. I'd like to live a healthy life until I die, but I don't want to live forever. For that reason.
Yeah, I love that, because when I read that and just heard you speaking about that, it makes all the sense. And especially as entrepreneurs and in business, there's, you know, if you can just put it off, I think one of the most, what makes some of the most successful entrepreneurs is that sense of urgency and that ambition. And we would probably not have so many other things and businesses and companies if you lived forever. And that's what I loved it. And I want to ask you, you know,
well, I didn't fully flesh out because I used the word ambition early in this conversation, and I didn't fully explain how I think it applies to me. But just give me a minute to do that.
I would love to.
Unfortunately, ambition has positive and negative connotations in modern time. The ambitious office worker is stepping on the, on the faces of and the necks of other people to move through. And so that's not really how I think about it. For me, ambition is I have a goal that I've set for myself, and I'm self-driven in accomplishing it. To me, that's ambition. I've always enjoyed writing. I think my verbal SAT was just kind of average. So no one will say, hey, he'll go far.
Right.
Watch him. He's got perfect scores on his verbal SAT. Watch him. And I'm thinking, no, I didn't get perfect scores, but I enjoy the written word. And so I kept learning, and I would read these beautiful essays in the New Yorker from people who wrote way better than I did and say, wow, that was a beautiful turn of phrase. Let me make a note of that. I bought some writing books, and I read speeches, and I read works of writing that are considered brilliant by other writers. And slowly, almost imperceptibly to me, my writing got better and better and better. And I realized this because one day I went back, my subscription gapped from the New Yorker. I went back maybe 5 years later, and I read one of the writings. I said, this sucks. It's like, I can write better. What's this turn of phrase? Write it this way. It would have been much better. So not all of them, but I realized I just kept ascending to the point where I was not growing inside of this unreachable goal of the writing talents of the average New Yorker writer. I was rising past that average. And I was able to look back and pass judgment on things that I possibly wouldn't have known how to do before. And so this culminated, holding aside my book, The Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, which was on the bestseller list for like 80 weeks.
It's pretty cool.
Bestseller, 80, like more than a year. It overlapped my next book that came out. Then I had two books on the bestseller list, okay? That was freaky right there, okay? So, do I run back to my English teacher and cram it in her face and say, this is what I did?
I know I would, but probably...
But no, I'm not that guy, but it's you can't deny the urge.
Yes.
And because they're always judging you for what you did in their class. And in all fairness to them, what else can they judge you on? I get it. But I don't mind them judging for my performance in their class. But if they use the performance to judge what I will ever become... Oh my gosh, that's the great tragedy.
Yes.
Teachers and the system that assess what you should not do in life based on whatever grade you did not get in their class. They are thwarting, if you are receptive to the advice of your teachers, they are cutting off possible pathways of curiosity that you may have had going in and are now broken.
Which is terrible. And you are here in New York City, and I'll tell you what, I have two kids in school here, and they have what they call a gifted and talented.
Don't get me started. Stop there. You'll get me angry.
I know.
You'll get me angry. Okay. One last thing about the thing was, again, I said I had sort of average grades. I mean, they were good, but nothing, like I said, that in the English, the verbal part of the SATs, nothing anyone would say, watch him, he'll go far. Nothing. So something like 15 years later, I have a column for a magazine. It's a monthly column on the universe, and I have fun with it, and I love turns of phrase. And so it's not just wiki pages of information. I think I'm writing to you, the reader, right? And I got a letter in the mail from the Educational Testing Service. These are the purveyors of the SAT, right? And just to show you what kind of a grip they still have on you, it's like,
yeah.
It's like they're rescinding my all right. So I opened it up and I said, "Dear Dr. Tyson," all right. So I figured, okay, they must be with me in the present. We read a recent essay of yours and we enjoyed it immensely, and we want to excerpt from it for the next verbal exam that we're using for the SATs. And I didn't know whether to say, fuck you! or Well, thank you for this compliment. You know, I was torn in that moment.
What okay? did you do? What did
no,
you do?
No, I gave. I mean, yeah, no, I'm not. You know, by inside and on the outside, right?
Yeah.
So as the comedian Bobby Collins had a whole comedy routine on that. So I was just angered me that they write an exam that other people use to pass judgment on my promise and performance and on my ambitions. And I continue with my ambitions and they have to come to me to fulfill the very same exam where my scores on those exams would not have ever allowed me to have achieved the heights that I did in that realm. So that's why my ambition is what I want to learn. It's what I want to think about. And I navigate pathways and other people who have achieved. I say, what books did you read? What shows have you watched? What podcasts do you listen to? I'm hungry and eager to learn at all times.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors.
For business owners, saving time is everything because each minute saved can be put back into growing your business. So when you need a business loan, U.S. Bank makes the process quick and convenient. Meet with a banker or apply from anywhere with a simple and secure online application and get a decision in minutes. Save time with U.S. Bank so you can get back to what you do best, running your business. Apply today at usbank.com/fundmybusiness. Credit products offered by U.S. Bank National Association, Equal Housing Lender.
And our next sponsor.
Work-life balance looks very different in 2020, and there are new challenges to your workday. Keeping yourself mentally healthy has never been more important, but if you're feeling stretched thin, you may need some help. With Calm for Business, companies can partner with the number one mental fitness app to provide support and tools for their employees. Calm has a library of content specifically designed to help work teams stress less, sleep better, and build mental resilience. Millions of employees at over 600 companies like Lincoln and Universal Studios are using Calm for Business. And right now, Calm is offering a free well-being guide and a free demo when you go to calm.com/HSH. And if Calm for Business is right for your team, they are also offering a free month of your first year when you go to calm.com/HSH. That's a free month of unlimited access when you go to calm.com/HSH. Get started today at calm.com/HSH.
And we're back.
And it sounds like something else that has definitely been a driver of your education and your life has been curiosity.
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't carry curiosity uniquely. It's a feature among all active scientists. And I've played with that concept just to say that since all children are born curious, we all were to the point of risking your life. Mm-hmm. Oh, what's this sharp edge? Or what's this cliff ledge? What's the, you know, or I wonder what this tastes like, okay? this rock tastes like, right? So below a certain age, you can kill yourself. But above a certain age, it's just sort of curiosity manifesting in harmless ways. And if you maintain that curiosity into adulthood, then you're a scientist. That's how I think of what it is to be a scientist. You're still a kid, turning over rocks and asking questions.
I want to talk about the business now, I guess, business of space travel. And hopefully I could get just some of your thoughts.
Oh, one other thing. Let me ask you. You're an entrepreneur. Yeah. Well, offer a quiz. How many of your fellow entrepreneurs were straight A students?
Okay.
You remove the fraction who dropped out of school, okay? Because that's that's okay.
Those are like the smartest of Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg.
Again, and that's why the word smart is not the thing, okay? It's just say they had a vision.
And I love that because I really find there's this saying like, the world is run by C+ students
and the straight A students work for the C+ students.
Yes. Yes, I have a lawyer that went to Harvard who works on my contracts, but I really agree with you because I'm going to do that. I'm going to ask entrepreneur because I would say if you looked at it, the most successful of all these folks were probably the ones who, like you, were CB student. I mean, you were higher, but myself, C minus, kind of, I'm at the low end of the spectrum. But I would bet the majority of folks, because it goes back to exactly what you said with ambition and having to learn and not just knowing the answer. You know, it's actually doing the work to find the answer.
Right, right. And I'll add to that, that the entrepreneur is also knows how to fail. And if you've got B's and C's in your life, you know how to not be at the top of your game. Whereas someone who's only ever gotten straight A's, do they really know how to fail? Really? Is this, can they emotionally survive a failure? I've seen people break out into a sweat at the prospect that they might have gotten a B in a class where all the rest of their school records are straight A's. And they're like shaking. I'm saying, chill out, dude. It's just a B. No, but I need straight A's. And it's like, okay, so they're after the A. They're not after the learning of the material. So there's a crossover between being enthusiastic about learning and only wanting the A because someone decided that that's, and you included, decided that that's your ultimate goal. And by the way, the gifted and talented students, they tend to be selected for how high grades they are in school. But also the fact that the very word gifted,
yeah,
excuse me,
I know, let me,
the it gifted kills is, me. I'm sitting here and someone hands you a gift. And I'm saying, okay, maybe some people are born really talented. Fine. Do they have the ambition to manifest that talent later on as an adult? Not always. But in addition, why can't it be the organization of people who work hard? How about that?
Love that.
And then that way, if I'm not gifted because I have to work harder than you do, but I can still achieve what you're achieving, I just have to work harder. I'll do that. But you're not going to let me in because I'm not designated as gifted. It is the worst possible name I can ever imagine labeling students. Because if you don't get that label, you're not gifted. And I told you I grew up with that bullshit. So don't. I told you, you got me angry.
I love it. Because
told you not
I am
to go there.
I like hearing it from you because you clearly are, and I don't want to label you, but you're extremely smart, and I won't say gifted.
He hasn't learned a thing.
I'm not talking about softball here, and you're so I'm talking about
he hasn't
which
learned
you're a very
thing.
Good player too. But I will say it bothers me so much as well, and it makes me so angry. And I really believe one thing you just said there, which I've found with the majority of folks I've interviewed, that persistence really trumps most everything else. Yes, you have to have, you know, you have to know what you're doing, but talk to me just
a
little bit
about persistence. That's the famous Edison quote. That's the famous Edison quote. Genius is 90%, you know, 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration, right? I mean, it's the work required is often undervalued by others who see highly successful people. For example, let's look at Michael Phelps. You know, we lost count of how many Olympic gold medals he has, right? And say, oh, well, he's got webbed fingers, or he's, you know, say whatever you're going to say. But at the end of the day, he's in a pool 6 hours a day. Are you in a pool 6 to 8? Are you that? No, you're not. All right. He's doing that. So maybe the webbed fingers, I don't know if he really has webbed fingers, but when people start invoking this, all right, it's like people talk about Michael Jordan. He's such a natural talent. Do you know he was like third round or something in the whatever? He was not first round, first pick in the NBA.
Yeah, and he also got big story with him was he, you know, never, he got cut from his JV basketball team. And they had a documentary on him, Last Dance, recently. And I was just...
You know, I'm one episode left on that. So
okay.
Thanks for reminding me.
I won't ruin the end for you. The Knicks don't win. But anyway. you know, it was just his mindset. I just thought that, to me, was what separated him from every other player I've watched. Maybe right. Except Kobe Bryant, who had a very similar mindset. It was just incredible, the determination.
And even holding aside, you know, the nasty moments where he would do things for spite. Whatever, I saw those as, while not noble, they were nonetheless motivating factors.
They motivated him. It was amazing. Right. He would make them up. It was just incredible how driven he was.
And all I'm saying is his ambition transcended the expectations of those who cut him from his JV team. And so that's, I think, the lesson here. And the gifted and talented programs should be open to anyone who works hard enough to demonstrate that this, and by the way, maybe we should include having ambition as a gift. How about that? Whether or not you're testing that way, but if you want to one day be great at something, chances are you're going to ascend higher than anyone is ever giving you credit for. So yeah, did I interrupted that last question? I keep interrupting you. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Well, yeah, I know we don't have too much time I love just talking to you because I'm learning so much. And I wanted to talk to you about space travel because it's on everyone's radar now and there's private companies doing it. I'm just curious on your thoughts about the industry itself and from NASA to the private companies and really if you can kind of give us a little bit of a lay of a land in what you see and what you think.
Sure. And by the way, I've written two books on this. One of them is called Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. That wasn't the original title of the book. The publisher rejected my original title. My original title was Failure to Launch.
I love
that Dreams and Delusions of Space Enthusiasts. Okay. That was my original title. But they said, you can't have the word failure in the title. All right. And then I had another book co-authored called Accessory to War, The Unspoken Alliance Between Astrophysics and the Military. And so everything we're about to tell you is contained in those two works, just so you know. I'm not pulling this out of the ether right now.
You did your due diligence.
But it's true for almost anything I say, I've probably written before in some way where I've thought about it and it's edited for length. Or
I don't know if you have time to play softball, but okay.
No, I don't. I don't really have time to play softball. So first of all, the commercialization of space should have been around decades ago. So this is it's unfortunately this late. It was imagined, I think, ambitiously in the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. The guy goes to the orbiting space station in a Pan Am shuttle. All right. Pan Am isn't around anymore, but it could be American Airlines, whatever. A shuttle goes to the orbiting space station, gets on the orbiting space station. It's rotating. So you have artificial gravity. So that's good. And there's a Howard Johnson's hotel there. And there's a restaurant and there's AT&T phone booth. And you say, wow, the future, if space is going to become real, is going to need the investments of private enterprise. Otherwise, you know, you can't sustain a space program forever if it's entirely based on tax money. You want to convert a space program into a space industry, you're going to have to make nice with the industries whose investments will form the buoyant force to make this happen. All right, so holding aside hotels and telephone calls, what rockets did NASA use during the golden age of our journeys to the moon? We already did have relationships with private enterprise, Grumman Aerospace and Lockheed and Martin Marietta. A lot of these have been consolidated. You have Lockheed Martin, you have Northrop Grumman, this sort of thing. But back then, every one of these companies were part of the space industrial complex. And NASA said, build this. We need it to go to the moon. They built it. We put it on a launch pad. It was an American flag, United States of America. It did not say Grumman. It did not say Boeing. It did not say Northrop. It had, because we paid for it. It was our ambitions getting us there. All right. So now, what's different today is we don't have a spaceship that's going to the moon or anywhere. So NASA looks over the fence. Who's got a spaceship? And then Elon Musk says, I have a spaceship. And so now NASA basically rents the spaceship. All right. In the same way that the U.S. Postal Service does not own airplanes, that would be pointless. Just rent space in the belly of Delta or whoever it is that they have the contracts with and let them carry it. And you know what their schedule is. And so you'll do that cheaper than if you try to run an airline. So this is the kind of thing where that should have been happening long ago. It's kind of happening now. Now, that's a separate conversation, and the press hasn't really figured this out yet. That's a separate conversation from who's going to lead our frontier in space. It's not going to be private enterprise. Not because I don't want it to be. It's just that it never has been. And there are really cogent reasons for this. All right. Imagine the venture capitalist meeting with Elon Musk. He gathers his most entrepreneurial VCs and says, okay, what do you want, Elon? I need $1 trillion. Why? I want to go to Mars. Does it really cost that much? Yes. Is it dangerous? Yes. Will people die? Probably. What's the return on that investment? None for the foreseeable future. That's a 5-minute meeting.
Exactly.
Just 5 minutes. Okay. So instead, the government says we need to go to Mars. Why? We have geopolitical reasons for doing this. China wants to put military bases on Mars. We don't want to let that happen. We have this budget. This is what we're going to do. Okay. Then we go to Mars. So it still might be Elon Musk's rocket, and that's still a business model for him. But what's paying for that? It's tax-based sources. It's not a fully freed, separated enterprise, a free market enterprise, if you're still connected to the needs of the government in what you sell. He can make a perfectly fine living, sustain factories and a large workforce by selling ships to the government with the government's intent to do this. But it means he does not absorb the risk, right? The government does. The government has very deep pockets. So what happens? We send humans to Mars. We build a base there. Well, now we know where the trade winds are. We've done this. We can write down what the risks are. How much wear and tear on the ship did it take? What did it cost? How did it cost to replace? Now let's hold a venture capitalist meeting, okay? Okay, I need $200 million to go to Mars, not a trillion. Is it dangerous? A little bit. Will people die? No, probably not. They already died for the government mission.
Right.
Right. So we've tested that already. What's the return on investment? Well, maybe in 5 years, we'll be the first ones there to set up the hotels, and we'll have year-long vacations that last there. And you start getting money at them. That's what happened with Columbus, okay? Was Columbus a private enterprise? There was some private money in what funded that. It was basically Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, okay? And what's the motivation? It's money, it's hegemony, it's military power, right? Queen Isabella didn't say, Chris, when you come back from the New World, give us a slideshow of what flowers you saw and the plant life and the people. No, it's here's a satchel of flags. Go plant them any place you land your ship in the name of Spain and find a shorter way to the Indies so that we don't have to go around the other side of the world. Economics and war, that's what drove that. Oh, after that happened, then comes the Dutch East India Trading Company. They absorbed none of the risks of Spain in doing so. And so you're going to lead frontier in space. My read of history tells me it will never be private enterprise.
It's amazing how you just put that. It made me see it so clearly.
If there was a rebuttal, I want to hear it. And we don't do stuff like that just because it's in our DNA. You do it because someone has a reason to pay for it. We falsely remember why we went to the moon. Oh, we're Americans. We're explorers. No, we were scared witless because the Soviet Union had put up the first satellite. They put up the first non-human animal. They put up the first human. They put up the first space station, the first woman, the first dark-skinned person, a black person from Cuba. They beat us in practically every measure of space achievement. And then we say, okay, what's the only thing we got left? Let's go to the moon. We went to the moon, and then we folded our arms and say, we win.
It's like I'm a sports guy. It reminds me of when the Patriots went undefeated 18-0, and then they lost to the Giants in the Super Bowl. But let me ask you.
I've forgotten about that one.
Yeah. I won't. Although I'm a diehard Jets fan, unfortunately, I hate to mention it. But let me ask you, thinking about that 50 years ago, putting a man on the moon, it's still, I mean, my mind, it baffles. What is the next? Is there another moment like that coming that
if we find oil on Mars, yeah, we're sending people to Mars. Well, that's the economic driver. Or if there's some geopolitical, usually militaristic reason for doing so. Otherwise, I don't see people on Mars ever. And the Mars people hate it when I said, no, we can do it. Well, because they think this. Do you remember my subtitle of my book that got rejected? It was
Failure to Launch.
Dreams and Delusions of Space Enthusiasts. And one of the delusions is we went into space because it was the next thing. If you look at the writings after we went to the moon, oh, we'll be on Mars by 1985. Why? Oh, because we went to the moon. Well, why did we go to the moon? Oh, because we're at war. Well, if war doesn't get us to Mars, we're never going to Mars. And it's been 50 years and we haven't been to Mars. And so again, I'm not defending this other than to say, this is my read of history. And I learn about human behavior and human motivations and why people spend money. They don't spend money just because it's fun to explore. Well, they do, but at a way smaller level. The Hubble telescope was sustained at a budget level below the let's rethink this radar level, all right? Once you start getting into billions of dollars a year, people rethink it every year. And if they can't see why it's in the interest of national security or the wealth of the country, those things don't tend to keep their funding. That's what happened to the super collider, all right? The superconducting super collider, the most powerful particle accelerator in the world, hired physicists, and this is Cold War, this stuff was proposed during the Cold War. Yeah, let's do it. And then the project was zeroed out in budget. When did that happen? Oh, right there in 1990, 91, around there. And, oh, but did something else happen around then? Oh, peace broke out in Europe. Oh, my gosh. Oh, all of a sudden, we don't need to spend this much money. We're not at war. Let's just be honest with ourselves. Let's just be honest. So I don't see us ever going to Mars with people. Robots, sure, but not people.
Yeah, that's super insightful.
Oh, there is a way to do it. You get the richest folks. You get Jeff Bezos when he's a trillionaire.
Like tomorrow, if the stock market's up today, he might be there.
Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and Blue Origin guy. Just get all of these.
Buffett
get all,
or
no.
Who's the?
You just get them all.
Yeah,
just get them all together.
All five of them.
All five, whatever, however many, and then they finance a first human mission to Mars, and then it's a one-off. It's a stunt.
Yeah,
but it's you're not creating a business model by doing so. But yeah, it'll be fun, and we'll all watch it. And, you know, here's a way you could do it. You have a lottery for who will go to Mars. And everyone spends a dollar. And, you know, half a billion people spend a dollar. And for each launch, you have $500 million to pay for it. And you know people would spend a dollar on that chance. And even if you don't go, there'll be the vicarious thrill of watching others. So that could be a way to do it.
I love that idea. We could do it in one weekend and have a mission to Mars with the way people love lottery. Well, Neil, I could talk to you all
day. I'm
sorry,
I did most of the talking here. I wanted to hear questions that you had collected from fellow entrepreneurs.
Oh, that's why I love talking to you, because it was far more interesting.
Throw one out there. Let's get a quick one. We got a couple of minutes. Throw one out.
Okay. I want to ask you, in terms of being an entrepreneur, if, you know, for yourself personally, how has that differed in the way your brain thinks, the way you are, you know, obviously a scientist, but you've actually had to run kind of, you know, you've had shows, books, now podcasts. How do you handle that? Is it the same way, you know, or
no,
do you go about
no.
it?
Each, thanks. Great question. Each platform is a different mode of communication, and different platform, different shows within the same platform have different audiences. So I invest more than you'll ever know on asking myself what's going on in the head of the person I'm speaking to, of the audience that is the core audience of that show, all right? I think about it. I don't have just some stump speech that I give. Often I'm accessing similar content, but words I use, phrases I use, my timbre, that adjusts to match an audience, to increase the possible bandwidth of communication, increase the diameter of the conduit through which that occurs. And yes, that takes effort. It takes a lot of effort. And the biggest compliment I can get is, I'll do a show, they say, oh, you're so natural. You have no idea. But I take it as a compliment, because they're complimenting all the work I put in to make it look like it's natural. So yeah, it's a lot of work. And people say, how do I balance life and family and domestic life? And my answer there is, it's never in balance, ever.
Yeah,
it's always out of balance. And every day I'm trying to prevent it from collapsing. And that forces some highly innovative solutions to your scheduling, to how you spend your time, how you allocate your energies. So no, I don't think the secret is balancing things. I think the secret is figuring out a way to not have the imbalance take you off rails.
Any tips or techniques that you've used? Because as entrepreneurs and our listeners, that is a lot of times the primary issue, just having time for everything.
Okay, I probably watch less football than you do.
Well, this year,
nowadays, that's 4 hours a game right there. Okay. Oh, no, sorry, the pregame show. Five hours.
And postgame. Don't forget that.
Yeah, because apparently everyone in the pregame show hasn't seen the game either, just like you. In the postgame show, you've all seen the game, but somehow you got to hear people talk about it. So I probably watch a little less football than you do. And other sort of moments in the day, interstitially, that come together, they add up. And I don't think, and plus when I see that one day I'm not going to be on this earth, I'll be dead and buried, those extra minutes become all the more cherished by me to try to learn something new. And don't keep reading stuff you already know or you already care about. Read things that conflict with your, or expose yourself to ideas that are completely far out there. And we don't live in those times. We live in a cancellation culture. You said something I don't agree with, I will never have a conversation with you again. That's a recipe for
Disaster. So Obama talked about it recently.
Yeah, it's
really scary. Mm-hmm.
I do it. I got to run.
All right, man. Hey, Neil, always good seeing you. Thanks
for
your insight.
Catch you on the softball field.
See you next year.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, bud.
Yeah, bye.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.